You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. Today I welcome back author Kenny W. Irish to discuss his latest book, International Cryptids and Legends, which was released last year. In it, Kenny dives into creatures, myths and magic all around the world, from Russia to South Africa to Vietnam and beyond. We've hairy hominids, giant bats, unexpected werewolves, and even man-eating plants all make an appearance. Kenny also updates us on his upcoming appearance at the Encounter Quest Con, which is held on April the 1st in Hamlet, North Carolina, too. A big thank you as always to Kenny. But before that, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, and more. You can also click the link in the show notes as usual. Mysteries and Monsters is across all social media platforms. Please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. And don't forget, you can visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for news, episodes, and Mysteries and Monsters merchandise. Thank you as always to Dean Bestel for his marvellous artwork. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. So, passports at the ready. Then let's head out across the world to find us some international cryptids and legends. As we become more connected around the world, for those of us that have a love of the strange, the mysterious and the weird, we now have a multitude of resources at our fingertips. As part of this, we can discover a whole world of cryptids lurking on every continent, and in his latest book, International Cryptids and Legends, Kenny W. Irish takes us around the world on the hunt for them. Kenny, welcome back.
Hey, Paul. Long time, no talk. We got to talk a little bit sooner next time.
Hey, that's all right. These things happen. I get used to this, and I appreciate that at the end of the day, the world does not revolve around me and my show, Kenny, so that's quite
all right. It should, though. It should. It's a good show. You're a good man.
Hey, that's very kind of you. Thank you. Hey, as always, as we were joking before we started, any of my guests are always happy to come back. All they have to do is ever drop me a line if they want a chinwag about something or they've got an upcoming project, and I'll be more than happy to try and fit people in whenever I can. So don't worry about that. It won't be that. I mean, I'm trying to think how long it is since we spoke. It's probably, is it 2 years?
Let me see. I believe it was after American Cryptids came out.
Yes.
And that came out in March of 2021. So I'd say close to it.
Blimey. It's one of those things. I often say this with some other guests. I've just had Paul Sinclair on, who's a big researcher over here. Yes. And we're really good friends and we speak quite a lot. But it's the first time he's been on for 18 months and he'd done sort of four shows in the same period prior to that. But I know I didn't want to bother him, Kenny, because he's just been finishing off a documentary. And sometimes I feel a bit like I might be sort of stepping on people's toes. And, you know, I'm always polite and I always ask nicely. I don't say, come on my show. I'll always say, would you like to join me for a conversation? So, don't worry. It certainly won't be 2 years till the next time we speak.
Yeah, no, definitely not. Definitely not. I mean, it would have been sooner if I hadn't dropped the ball in the last one. So I take full responsibility.
Hey, it happens to the best of us. We all have to rearrange things. Life gets in the way, my friend. So it's never a problem. And I appreciate your candid kindness. That's very kind of you. But no skin off my nose in the slightest.
All right. Excellent.
So obviously, you've got the second book. Before we dive into this new one that you've got international, how did American Cryptids continue then? So I know it had just been updated and re-released the last time we spoke. So how's the continuing feedback in regards to that, Kenny, as you've continued to build your reputation and get out and about far more than you were?
It's been phenomenal. The publication has been very, very well received. Three times in the first year it was number one on Amazon. So it's done very well. A lot of people are really kind of if you live in the States, I mean, there's a personal connection, you know, when you read the book, because I document, you know, history of certain states, not just the monsters or creatures that that roam the land there. So if you, for instance, I'm born in Vermont, born and raised in Vermont, and I live in New York now, but you know, if I pick up a book and it covers a certain state, I always go right to the home state that I grew up in and read, you know, what they wrote about it. So for a lot of people, you know, it was not just a fun book talking about cryptids, monsters, Bigfoot sightings, but it was also a little personal because they were able to look back and read what I wrote about the state that they grew up in or that they currently reside in. So I think that's part of, again, what kind of helped the book be as successful as it was and still actually is. It's still trending very, very well right now with the numbers. And I did recently hear that it's going to be also put on an audiobook as well. So I'm, you know, kind of excited about that.
Oh, brilliant. Congratulations. I wish you the best of luck with that audiobook, because so are you going to be doing that, or is somebody going to be doing it on your behalf?
Somebody will be doing it on my behalf.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, congratulations. I mean, it is always good when you get a collection such as that particular book, Kenny, like you say. It's the same with anything. Anything that's sort of catalogued in such a way or set out in that kind of format, wherever, there'll always be things, even for me, obviously not as an American, there will always be places or countries I'm interested in where there will be a particular place or state that I'm interested in more than anything else. So often, for me, usually it's those states that I don't know too much about so much, and I've learnt to really appreciate certain states that aren't probably the cool ones, like Montana. So no offence to anybody in Montana, but I've learnt to adore the Big Sky State. I just find it an incredibly interesting and beautiful place. So it's the same with anything. Even here, if there's books about the UK, I'll always sort of dive into sort of Yorkshire and Derbyshire and Lincolnshire, because they're the counties nearest to where I live and around Yorkshire. And it's good, because even though you think you know a lot, you'll always discover something new.
Yeah. Oh, agreed. And in part of the formula of the publication was also, you know, where I wrote it in such a sense where I feel like I'm taking people on a journey across the country, like I'm your tour guide. And, you know, I wrote it like that in a sense where it's not just written out and I'm just kind of throwing information at people. It's like, you know, it's like, and here we are coming into blah, blah, blah. Again, I wanted it to be different and I wanted it to be fun. I wanted people to not just feel like they're reading a book that I wrote, but like I'm actually there with them, and just kind of roll with it like that. So, and it was the same formula with International Cryptids and Legends as well. Each chapter opens up and gives some you know, historical facts on the territory that we're covering, and then goes and talks about different legends and lore from that certain territory and area.
I suppose when you're pulling an international book together, would you say that you'd got this germ of the idea when you were finishing off American Cryptids, Kenny, that you thought it was a natural progression to just kind of cast your eye abroad? Or were there always creatures? Because I know, as we spoke last time, you've always had a love of monsters throughout your life. And for many people, most of us know the big hitters. If you're living in North America, you will look towards the Himalayas or Loch Ness in regards to certain things. So did you have an idea of which countries you wanted to do? Because I would imagine when you're doing an international cryptid book, the biggest challenge is where to go.
Yeah, that definitely, without a doubt, was the first challenge was, you know, where do I start? So I pretty much just kind of went through and I was like, okay, well, first of all, I knew that I wanted to cover Russia.
Yeah.
I knew I wanted to cover Russia. And so I picked the few that I knew, you know, right out of the bat. I knew I wanted to cover Germany, Madagascar. And then from there, I just kind of went through the countries and I was like, you know what? Malaysia sounds like it would be a good time. Hey, you know, let's do Australia. Let's do Haiti. So, in Vietnam. So that's kind of how I went through. And, from there, I just went and started, you know, researching, you know, the history on that actual territory and, you know, the different, legends that dwell out of those areas. And the funny thing is this book originally was titled International Cryptids. Now, the reason it's now titled International Cryptids and Legends was, as I was going through each country, I noticed that a lot of the creatures and a lot of there was more legend out of the U.S. than in the U.S. where, you know, we have our popular monsters, if you will, in the United States. But when you leave the U.S. and you go out there, I mean, everything gets really creepy, gets really spiritual. And I realized that, you know, I'm going to be covering more than just monsters, if you will, in this book. I'm going to be covering different legends of spirits and different types of entities that, you know, many people may not have heard of. So it went from, you know, being mostly focused on something that could be flesh and blood to a lot of religion and a lot of spirits, if you will. So that's why I'm like, all right, well, I'm not covering just cryptids in this one. I am going right to legends, even though I covered a couple, I'd say more legend, spiritual legends and American cryptids. The majority of it had to do with monsters and creatures. Well, this one is definitely a combination of both. And I even think some of the chapters might even cover more, spiritual legends than actual monsters.
Mm. I think sometimes when you look at some of these creatures and some of these countries, the lines between what's a flesh and blood creature and what's a creature of myth and legend are very blurred, Kenny. It can be very difficult to unpick it.
Oh, I 100% agree. And the other thing, too, is there were so many legends that I came across. I was like, this is just awesome. This is just completely awesome. I have to, I think this is the coolest thing. I have to put this in the book. I have to do it. And so again, it kind of, my original direction with the book shifted. I kept the same formula, but from there, it really shifted and went into a different direction.
I suppose as well, I'm very interested in regards to the process with this, Kenny, because obviously the book has 11 different countries from several continents. So I'm always impressed when I see a book that covers countries that don't usually get a look in. And I know there's at least a couple in your collection, Ecuador and Ghana. Primarily, are two that most people would not expect to find in a book of cryptids and legends, regardless. And I think primarily because, you know, even though these are two very well-established countries known throughout the world, I think often sometimes places like that get overlooked for other countries nearby them.
Yeah, you know, there's in some of it, I think, has to do with the fact that other territories that are close by, you know, may have something that is extremely its characteristics of some type of legend, you know, that is talked about in the U.S. as well. So it's sometimes it's an easy go to. And like I said, I don't know. Once I started writing this book, I was just kind of intrigued on where I could actually go with it. What I did notice is, you know, a lot of these legends out of the country, out of the U.S., are very much, how do I say it? Like, there isn't a ton of information on it either, which to me was actually a good thing, because sometimes I think when there's too much information, like the actual legend itself can kind of get diluted. And but for a lot of these, a lot of it was just the same information. No matter how hard I researched, I was coming up with the same information. So if I already had my notes and I already had the majority of that portion done, and I'm trying to, you know, look for other different aspects of that legend, I wasn't finding it. And it's like people out of the U.S. take these legends so serious, like they don't even allow anybody to add to it or change anything, or and there's like I
couldn't find people's opinions in it. It was just, this is what it is.
Mm.
And so it's like they really respect the legends. They really respect what's been passed down over the years. So it's, for me, it was definitely eye-opening to find less where, you know, you look at something, you know, in the like Mothman or something like that in the U.S., every time I turn around, I'm finding new stuff on it, new articles or this, or somebody wrote this, or, you know, somebody's saying this or that. Outside of the U.S. now, it's like they hold their legends near and dear, and you're not allowed to mess with it.
Mm. I think it can be very problematic, like you say, because often it depends how far in certain aspects you're willing to go back and dive into certain things. As you say that, as you mentioned, Mothman is a prime example, because the version of Mothman now doesn't really bear as much relevance to the original investigation by Keel, because now there are all kinds of other bits, and there are people adding chunks to it from other countries and creating other mythos around it. And we're getting more modern sightings allegedly in different parts of the US again.
Yeah.
So it's very interesting where you look at what it was to what it's become. And that tends to, I mean, another prime example of that is the Chupacabra, because it's a real bone of contention, because what the Chupacabra often gets portrayed as these days is simply not the same creature that was reported in Puerto Rico back in the mid-90s. Essentially, it's 28 years ago this month that the first sighting was reported on that particular farm back in 1995, Kenny. So what people consider to be a Chupacabra in certain parts of the Americas now is a very different creature. And I suppose when you're looking at other countries, as you say, they seem to have kept the majority of them very pristine as they were originally described or encountered.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, in the US, our legends evolve.
Yes.
Which really shouldn't happen. they should remain the same, and it should be passed down. And so when I'm going through, you know, different monsters and cryptids in the US, I really, again, I've always mentioned this, like, I really try to go back as far as I possibly can to the oldest information that I can find on it, because a lot of the, what I'll come across, a lot of the newer information that's put out is the story or the legend is kind of overly sensationalized, where it's kind of like there are certain things that were said that were done that happened in certain aspects of the legend back then. But then when you read about that now based off of then, there's so much added to it. And a lot of the time it's people's theories that are added into it, but added in such a way where it's read like, okay, yeah, this theory was when this originally happened. This was a theory back then, even though it wasn't, you know, this is a theory that came out 30 years later, but it's associated with it in such a way where it sounds like, yes, this has always been there. Again, it's just the story and the legend shouldn't evolve. It should stay the same. It should be continued to pass down. I mean, I get it. You know, people may see something, you know, that resembles it and they can talk about it, but at the end of the day, it really shouldn't, again, it shouldn't change the commonality of the end of the story. It should still be the end of what the legend was.
Mm, yeah. And I suppose as well, the other aspect is that there are thousands of channels on YouTube, and a lot of people can sometimes fall down the wrong path when you come to this and end up discovering a whole incorrect or badly researched selection of information about a particular cryptid or a particular legend, Kenny, that essentially gives you the modern version, not the historical one.
Sure. Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. And, again, that's that kind of, and I see that a lot because, you know, like mentioned before, you know, I try to go back as far as I possibly can. And then, you know, when I see something newer come out, and again, it's more sensationalized, it's more modernized. And I think that kind of steals to a degree the, what's the word I'm looking for? I guess I'm just going to use this word, the awesomeness of what the original legend was.
Well, yeah, I think often when you come across certain ones, it's the original encounter or a certain specific early witness that kind of sells that particular cryptid to you, and you, or that particular legend, and you're like, that's the one that gets your fire going.
Yeah.
I suppose as well, as you were saying about when you were pulling it, when you were setting the book out, obviously you'd got the countries that you were going to focus on, Kenny. Did you try and sort of write one country and then move on to the next? Or was it a case of you'd got your targets, you knew what you were doing, and then you were kind of jumping back and forth as you were discovering new things or uncovering ones that you thought deserved inclusion in the collection?
No, I definitely, if I had been jumping back and forth, we wouldn't be having a conversation right now on the book, because I'd still be working on it. My mind, if I don't stay focused on one thing, I don't accomplish anything at the end of the day. So for me, it was, okay, I started out with this one country, and I just stayed focused on it. I stayed focused on it until I was completed, or I felt like it was completed. I represent, you know, the representation of the legends and the history on it was solid. And then I went on to the next one. I will say that the first chapter I wrote was Russia, but the way that they're lined up in the book isn't necessarily like the second one in the index, for instance, is Malaysia right after Russia. I can tell you Malaysia was one of the last countries that I covered. So what I kind of did was I went through after I completed each chapter and then just kind of lined them up in such a way where if, let's say, one of the territories had more cryptids like then spirits, the next chapter I tried to kind of keep it a little more spirited and just kind of break it up, so it wasn't, okay, you had three of them that covered more cryptid flesh and blood type of creatures, and then the next three were more spiritual. I wanted to kind of put it in such a way where it wasn't, you know, monotonous, if you will. But yeah, at no point in time could I go back and forth. I had to pay attention. If I was writing about Russia, I had to pay attention to Russia, because my mind would end up clogging and then putting the wrong things in the wrong places. And again, you know, I really wanted to represent the territory and the legends in the best light and the best possible way that I could. So I knew if I didn't stick to just moving forward with it and focusing on that one territory, it would have been a hot mess.
Well, that's an excellent example of keeping your focus, Kenny, because like you say, I would imagine regardless of the temptations, you've got to know your limits, know what you're going to do and stick to it, because otherwise, as you say, you end up going all over the place or misincluding information in certain sections where it doesn't deserve to be. So I mean, when you were doing this, was there any one of these legends or creatures that you discovered that absolutely blew your socks off, that you just thought, whoa, why have I never really heard about this thing before?
Yeah, I mean, I'd heard about this legend, but never really, really looked into it. It was Baba Yaga.
Yeah.
And I knew of the legend, but never really, really looked into it, because, again, you know, I'm more of a cryptid monster type of guy. So I was really, you know, blown away by it and about that legend. And there was, let me see, some of them, to be honest with you, I can't even pronounce their names correctly. So I try not to, but they're like the Bakru, which is a spirit dwarf. You know, there was all these again that just jumped out at me that really just kind of pulled me in. Like the Caribbean crowing snake. Let me see, of Haiti. The Madagascar man-eating tree.
Yes.
The giant fossa. Let's see, the Alps. And I don't know if I'm going to pronounce this correctly, but it's Nashira. which is described as an undead creature found in Poland, a northern territory of Germany. Mm. A terrifying legend. So there were so many of them that were just, you know, that really, really jumped out at me. I was at times actually kind of disappointed that I couldn't find more information on them, you know, because it's like you find something and you're just really kind of excited about it, and then it's just kind of done. So it was kind of disappointing, but then again, at the same time, I appreciated it because I wasn't being, you know, kind of set down a path of just modernized opinions and theories, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, when I ever see collections of certain territories that seem to be from around the world, Kenny, I'm still a little bit surprised to keep discovering. It doesn't seem to be wherever you are in the world, there are usually two types of creatures that continually appear on the radars of either legends or cryptids or whatever they wish to call them, which are hairy hominids and giant serpents of some description. So
yep.
Were you surprised to see that wherever you seem to go in the world, I mean, obviously in the book, you've got hairy hominids from Russia, Vietnam, especially, obviously Australia. Are you even as somebody with a real interest in this particular subject, are you still surprised that it seems that wherever you go in the world, there seems to be two or three reoccurring themes wherever they are?
I'd say if you asked me this question about 30 years ago, I'd say yes. But now, no. And I would say the beautiful part about this too, you know, we have this thing called the internet now and Google, and everything is right at your fingertips. You go back like 30 years and you read the books and you find out all these individuals in different countries were seeing a similar type of creature, bipedal hairy hominoid creature or something, some large creature in the water, some aquatic serpent. And, you know, to have that amount of information in that many, so, because, you know, like you had mentioned, I mean, almost every country has some type of serpentine, dragon-like creature that has been spotted in the water, that's been spotted in the sky, even, you know, flying through the sky. So, I think I'm, you know, I'm kind of changing my answer of what I originally gave you to. It's surprising. I guess it's surprising to me, you know, going back and I don't know. The more I think about it, the less I'm surprised. And then when I think about it again, I'm surprised. So it's one of those things where I guess this is one of the reasons I love these subjects, because, you know, sometimes when things you have a simple answer and a simple feeling and a simple direction, it can get boring. And I've noticed with this subject, like you really can't get bored, because there's constantly, I don't know, anywhere you look, there's these legends. So it's like, let's say I did get bored of the legends and everything in the United States, even though there's a lot of them. And there's a lot of them, you know, that I still hear about. I'm like, really? I've never heard of that. But when you leave the U.S. and you go to these other territories, I mean, your mind's blown. It really is when you look at the different aspects and the way that the individuals approach these legends and really what they are. And some of the legends can be really kind of goofy and silly. And then on the other hand, that same legend can also have a real dark side to it as well.
Mm. Mm. It is surprising as well when you look at them. I mean, as you say, some of them can be quite goofy. I think probably one of them that springs to my mind is the Grootslang from South Africa, yeah, which is supposed to be this giant serpentine creature. But people also describe its sort of front quarters as being elephant-like, which is one of those that makes you scratch your head and think, what? How can that be? And you see that sometimes with some other kind of cryptids and creatures from around the world, where we have this kind of mashup of known species that you think, well, how can that be? But then you look at nature, in all its forms. And we find all kinds of crazy creatures. Yeah, very famous situation with that is obviously the first platypus that was sent to the British Museum was dismissed as a cruel hoax because they couldn't believe a creature could be like that with the, you know, the bill of a duck and the body of a rodent, it would seem. Kenny, that laid eggs, they were like, what on earth is this? Who's put this together?
Yeah, exactly. You know, you mentioned the Grusslang. You know, some of the theories are when it was first seen there was like a giant snake, and when it was the individuals came across it and saw the creature, it was a giant snake and it was devouring an elephant.
Mm.
And when they came around the corner, they saw this snake that was larger than life and it looked like its head was an elephant, but it was just because it was in the middle of devouring it. And that the legend kind of sprung and flew from there. You know, but then, you know, the other side of it is that, you know, there was a god that, you know, that wanted to be the most powerful god and, you know, decided to combine some animals together and then it got loose and that's how we have the Grusslang.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of like a very odd cousin of the Tatzelworm, which is obviously from sort of the Germanic regions as well.
Yeah.
Anyway, you've got these very odd serpents. And I suppose you would think of countries such as Germany and that particular region, because they get very cold in the winter, a lot of people just presume that there can't possibly be snakes. I'm not sure why we've got this opinion that snakes only exist in certain countries or in hot climates. Obviously, they're a reptile, so you would presume that any sort of monstrous one would suffer even more when the cold weather hits. But obviously, we've got snakes here in the UK and they're across Europe, so why wouldn't they appear in certain countries where you'd get mountainous regions? And obviously, the Tatzelworm is one of the most famous ones.
Yes. Yep. I agree.
When you were looking into, as you say, the first chapter is covering Russia, I think the Russian one is probably the most famous one is the Yeti or the Yeren or the Almas or Almasti, depending on which part of the enormous country you go into. That clearly has had a lot of traction over the last sort of 10 or 15 years, primarily for two reasons. I think we've got obviously what happened at Dilatalov Pass. And,
yes.
And some of the theories in regards to that, Kenny. And also, we've also, in this modern era, we've got discover things that there are people in Russia who do the same thing as you or I, that have a deep love of monsters, and they seem to be, as we were saying about the book, they seem to be everywhere. And when you unpick it, similarly to China, you understand that they've got a real history of hairy hominids in this particular country, and they seem to have different versions of it.
Yeah. Yes.
When you're looking at that, I suppose it's which one do you cover? And if so, what's the main difference between them? Did you find it difficult to sort of unpick what was what when you were looking at the Russian hominids?
Not really. It was, I guess, it kind of came down to, you know, looking at the legends that were there, what was talked about. And, I mean, there were times where I was like, okay, you know, I'm just going to put everything in this chapter. And then I realized, you know, that would end up being a whole book in itself, which is fine. And I could have done that. Again, you know, my goal is to kind of, you know, be taking people on a journey, you know, through different territories. So, but yeah, there's always, okay, well, which ones am I going to pick? Which ones am I going to put in here? Like, you know, in the US there, I mean, you always have your popular legend of that state. Just, you've got the popular legend of that state. And so that was pretty easy, but leaving the US and going into these international territories, they all are very, I guess there's some that really stick out more than others, but for the most part, like I said earlier, like they're all very well respected. So it's not like there's one that's really focused on more. A legend in an international territory is taken serious, where, you know, we might take, you know, one of the ones in the U.S. In a certain state. Okay, well, this is kind of like our state monster. You know, each state kind of has something that's kind of like their state monster, if you will. It's not like that in these other countries.
Yeah, some countries seem to hold their creature up on a very high pedestal as well. They seem to be very proud of it. I think it depends where you go. Certain countries seem to look at it. I mean, obviously, you can see that as you were referring there about some of the states in the US. They seem to wear their particular cryptid as a badge of honor, Kenny. You know, Jersey Devil is probably a prime example of that, or some of the weirder ones like the Dover Demon and the Enfield Horror, which was one, I have to admit, that up until about 4 or 5 years ago, I'd never heard of at all. And when people were talking about it, I presume they were talking about the poltergeist here in London. So I was very surprised to hear about this weird three-legged creature that was running around terrorizing people.
Yeah.
So you're always learning things. I know one of the ones I'd completely forgotten about, even though I was a massive fan of Destination Truth, is the Fangalobalo from Malaysia. Madagascar, sorry. Which is one of those that I think these are the kind of creatures that kind of give me the creeps, as you were saying earlier, where you're talking about, we're talking about large bat-like creatures, Kenny, in certain countries where you just think, ooh. I mean, I love bats. I think they're incredible. We've got a large population where I live, and it's amazing to watch them at dusk bombing about everywhere and taking down all the insects for tea. But there's something about bats to a certain size where they seem to cross over from reality to terror.
Yeah, 100%, 100%. Same thing with spiders.
yes, absolutely. I think it's because we know they're so intelligent that you think if they get to the same size as a large dog, we're all in trouble.
Yeah, agreed.
Was there any of the creatures that you uncovered or wrote about in the same way that we're talking about the Fangalobalo that gave you the creeps, or one that you're really glad it's far away from where you live?
Yeah. Fumbalogo. And I think I just fumbled the name, but that was, I'd say the Bunyip was definitely one. Let me see. And one that, you know, is very, very different, but like the sky serpents in China, like that kind of creeped me out. You know, the thought of, again, like serpents, like flying around, like in the sky, you know, because it's like, you know, you're looking on the ground when you're looking for different types of like serpents and stuff, you know, like snakes. And I just can't imagine having something up in the air and then coming down, you know. It's just like, you're not even going to see that coming. So, you know, I had to make sure that I kept my mind in check while I was writing these chapters out. But there was definitely, without a doubt, a lot of just weird, creepy, like, what if type of legends that, like, what if I was in that country and what if I was in that territory? And you know, that obviously helped, you know, write the book, having that what if, because, you know, as I'm thinking about it and picturing it, I'm trying to, you know, put that in writing based off of, you know, the research that I've done about that certain legend. So it definitely helped. But at the end of the day, yeah, I mean, I'm always happy when I'm in the States, I guess I should say.
It's just Bigfoot and Dogman you have to watch out for, usually.
Yeah, exactly.
I know you mentioned it earlier, and it's one that always makes me chuckle when it turns up, because it's one of the few man-eating plants that I'm aware of in the world of monsters. Because it's one of those, well, you think, well, is it a cryptid because it's a plant? But if it's a plant, why does it eat people? But then you think, well, we know there are certain plants that are carnivorous, as strange as it may seem. Obviously, the Venus flytrap is probably the most famous around the world, Kenny. And yet this one, the Yatveo, as it's, I think, see, you're on about butchering names, and I'm trying my best as well. Is one of those that you think, this can't be true. But as I say, you look at nature, we know that plants do eat meat, certain species of them. So this world is a weird place in certain areas. Why wouldn't there be some kind of... And to be fair, if you came across it, I don't think many people would live to tell the tale anyway, Kenny.
Yeah, no, I agree. 100%, 100%. And that was another one of those legends where I was like, okay, I want to cover this. This is very cool. And you know, but I didn't see a man-eating tree as a cryptid. So it was another example of why it turned into and legends.
Well, yes, because some, you know, this is a prime example. This is a story that's too good not to include. So
yes.
And often people say, oh, well, you know, in that period, people were just making up any old nonsense. And you think, well, not everything that newspapers were printing, and there's, you know, some amazing discoveries in the animal and plant kingdoms were done at the latter part of the 19th century, and the appetite and explorations that were going on around the world showed that there was a real thirst for these kind of stories, Kenny. But is it surprising? You know, when we look at this and, you know, with the greatest of respect, nobody is an expert in this particular field at all. We're always learning. There are always things we're going to uncover we're not aware of, or we've not really read enough about or researched, regardless of where it is or what it is. Are you surprised there aren't more stories of a similar nature, pardon the pun, from around the world about giant man-eating plants? Or is it the fact that they're there, we just haven't uncovered them as yet?
I really see that as something that a lot of people see as kind of like a fairy tale, or in like a Harry Potter type of fantasy type of setup. So I think that might be kind of why, you know, I mean, for instance, with these creatures, you know, that are said to roam the earth, and, you know, people are saying that they see them all the time. You know, there's reports coming in all the time of creatures and unusual weird beings that people can't identify or can place or be able to say, yes, this should be here. So I think it comes down to, you know, I've never talked to anybody that's been like, oh yeah, I came across this man-eating tree. You know, so I think that that's kind of why it doesn't really get talked about, because if there is a man-eating tree out there and somebody comes across it, we can go out and find it because it's not getting away. So I think,
you know,
I think the legend behind it is really cool. But I think, you know, a lot of people would be just like, OK, well, you know, if it's a tree, you know, it's stuck to the ground, so we should be able to go and see it. So If it was more than just a legend and you know, more than, you know, just a myth, if you will, I think we probably wouldn't be as excited about them because we would be seeing them all the time. So, but again, I needed to have that in the book when I came across it, because this is a legend. This is something people feared. And there's stories that go along with it. And I wanted to be one of the people to, you know, with excellence, represent it.
Were you surprised to discover a history of werewolves in Haiti?
I was. And then when I discovered it, I thought, how badass is that? You know, I'm just like, wow, you know, werewolves running around in Hades. It's like when you think of Hades, a lot of the time, you know, different individuals I talk to, you know, like for some reason, you know, they think of like black magic and different things like that. I never actually thought of any type of werewolf, anything like that. So that really intrigued me, and I got kind of sucked in, and I was like, all right, this is going in the book. I love this.
Mm. It's one of those that seems to be surviving into the modern era as well, that people will still prescribe mysterious deaths or murders, not only of livestock, which is obviously one of its prime sources of food, but also people disappearing, Kenny. They will prescribe this to their werewolf still.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's the thing. Like, it's not just a legend from the past. It's still talked about. It's still feared. It's still supposedly happening to this day. So, what that means is that is it the Haitian version of the American Dog Man? Who knows? But, it's definitely, like I said, it was, again, another one of those ones I had to add into the book because I was just like, you know, I never even thought of this. This never even occurred to me.
It is. I mean, when you read the chapter and you read about it, it makes sense because obviously, I know, as you say, there are several names for it there. Jajouge, Red Eyes, the French Loup-Garou or the Loup-Garou as well, which is obviously something it's something that most people would presume tends to be connected with the southern states. But obviously, I've read stories from Canada as well, Kenny, where they mention the Loup-Garou, which is clearly showing you something is deeply ingrained in French culture, that wherever they go, so do the werewolves. But then I suppose people would expect them to be werewolves living amongst them if they're traveling around.
Yeah. Especially, you know, if it's bipedal and it you know, walks, it's going to travel.
One of these interesting aspects of all this werewolf dogman thing is that even the name itself kind of leads to my point there. Have you ever come across a case where someone's claimed, because I can only really think of one off the top of my head right now, which is the werewolf of Talbot County in the US, Kenny, of a female werewolf or dog woman even. Have you, when you've been doing some research or doing some talks, because I know you, when you do presentations, you've done dogman presentations at certain events that you've been at. Have you seen any other stories like that? Or would you say that the majority of witnesses report seeing a male dogman or werewolf?
They at no point have ever once ever said whether they believe it's male or female. It's always kind of assumed that it's male because, you know, we automatically go to dog man. And then when you think of werewolves, I mean, 9 times out of 10, you think of the movies and you think of, you know, there were men that turned into werewolves. So never once has anybody ever actually brought up a gender. They've only just been like, hey, you know, I saw a dog man, or, you know, my cousin saw a dog man, or, this individual, that I'd spoken to, believe that they saw what looked like a werewolf, but it's never actually come up. And that's an interesting question that you mentioned that, or you ask that because again, no one's ever actually pointed anything out. No one's ever said, hey, it looked like it had breasts or anything like that. Nothing to this day. So that's actually an interesting question.
It is. I mean, even in popular culture, female werewolves tend to be on the lesser scale. I mean, the only films I can really think of off the top of my head is the Howling series, which has had several female werewolves in them. Everything else, as you say, even going back to the Universal films and the Hammer films, it was always a male that was cursed in some way. And that seems to continue. Obviously, Ginger Snaps is a more modern version, which is obviously one of my favorite films of the last 20 years, especially in the werewolf genre. So, I think it's one of those that people just presume it must be male. So who knows? There might be another. I mean, then again, you would suggest, well, would you really want to be that close where you could discern the gender of this creature chasing you down the road, Kenny?
And it's funny you ask that because the thing is like, you know, I if I ever come across a creature that is bipedal, 6-7 feet tall, that looks like a werewolf, I'm certainly not going to ask them what their pronouns are. I'm not even going to have that conversation. I don't even think that's even going to matter to me. So,
yeah, I think usually you probably get as far as, excuse me, are you, and that'd be it.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
So we'd never find the answer anyway. Or if we did, unfortunately, you would have been turned by the creature and probably want to protect it.
Yeah.
When you've done this book, have you developed a respect for certain territories you weren't aware of or thought, I'm really, you know, even for your own personal interests, Kenny, have you thought, I really want to learn a lot more about that particular area of the world now?
I would say every single one of the chapters that's in there. Because I kind of, you know, you spend enough time on something, you kind of, in your mind, you're kind of living there as you're writing it. So you kind of come across with a little bit of a bond, like bonding with it. And it's like with anything else that you write, you know, when you put in, you know, when you put that time into it and, you know, you picture it and it kind of becomes, I guess, in a sense, somewhat of a part of you. So I would say every single one of them. And then, you know, when I write another book and it's more countries, I'm going to probably feel the same way about them, because I'm going to feel like, in a sense, I've been there, even though I haven't set foot on the ground, which I'd love to one day. But I'll definitely feel, you know, like I do feel like I've been there, in a sense, and that I've not physically but mentally kind of experienced the culture and the way of life.
Mm. I think as well, often Vietnam is a prime example of this, because one of the most famous creatures from the Asian area is the rock apes. And I think a lot of places we don't have the ability or the facility, Kenny, to get in there and do real expeditions. Obviously, Vietnam is somewhere that's opened up a lot more since the ramifications of the conflict in the 60s and 70s. But there would be other places. China is another one where international cryptozoologists probably don't get an opportunity to go and visit due to conditions and situations completely out of their control, which is a real shame, because the rock ape story is one that some people have gone and done, but people seem to just touch it, and it seems to be one of these that is primarily based on the reports and encounters of GIs during the war.
Yeah, yes.
Do you think that's a shame? And I would imagine, do you think that there are more creatures and encounters that we're simply not aware of because of where they happen?
I would have to say yes, for the simple fact that it, there's probably more, because there's less people in the area, you know, going around trying to chase them. So they're probably coming out more often, because a lot of encounters in other countries with different types of creatures are people that just happen to come across them. You know, nobody's out there, you know, per se banging on trees, yelling, doing this, doing that, trying to actually research them. In most cases, I mean, they kind of just respect the fact that they're there, and they do a little bit of, you know, research on them, you know, follow them around a little bit, but, you know, they don't really go after them in a sense, as in like they're trying to, you know, prove like we do in the States, like here in the US, it's like, you know, all these people going out looking for Sasquatch. It's like, you know, there's so many of them that are like, oh, you know, I want to prove the existence. And they're going at it kind of full force, where in these other countries, I really think, like I said earlier, that there's a respect for the legend, and there's a respect for the entity or being itself, where in the US, I don't necessarily see it as much. A lot of it is looked at as going out and doing it, you know, it's entertainment and for self-worth and, you know, to get likes and, you know, follows, where in these other countries, it's not necessarily like that. Like, that's not really a focus, if you will.
I mean, for me, it's quite frustrating as well, because obviously one of the things I've been aware of for a very long time is that clearly Japan has a real thirst for monsters, because there are numerous examples of scientific expeditions around the world, Kenny, that Japan has sent all over the place looking for monsters. So clearly there's a whole raft of Japanese research that a lot of us don't have any access to, or if we did, unfortunately, we'd probably struggle with the language barrier.
Oh yeah, I agree. I agree 100%.
Well, it's a wonderful collection, and like you say, there are some that I'd never heard of, there are some that have taken me
back in time to remembering episodes I'd watched late at night of Josh Gates running around the world. Well, this is probably another aspect of all this. A lot of these countries will just wait till Josh turns up with his team, Kenny.
Yeah.
Investigating creatures all over the place, because I know he's done several of these more obscure creatures, which is always interesting as well when people do shows these days, that they don't just focus on the greatest hits, as it were. It's not always Sasquatch and Bigfoot and Dogman. They will go out around the world and look after, you know, creatures like the Lusker is another one from the Caribbean that has only sort of recently made its sort of debut on TV. And I know when we spoke last time, Monster Quest was very good at looking at certain subjects that probably didn't normally get covered as well as the big hitters.
Yeah, you know, and you mentioned Destination Truth, and I have to say, still to this day, that is one of my top five favorite shows.
Yeah, I used to love it. I mean, and it's one of those that it was only shown once over here in the UK. It's never been repeated for some reason, Kenny.
Yeah, I think there was only two seasons.
Yeah.
Maybe three. I don't believe there was a lot.
Yeah. So it's very odd, because it was on about, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago, because it was on during that sort of end of the noughties period where we had some really great cryptid TV flying around. And then, I don't understand, because I think it was on the Discovery Channel as well. So you would imagine, going on the fact that you're running several channels that run 24 hours a day, Kenny, that they would be showing it somewhere at some point.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure in this day and age where everything's streaming, you know, you could definitely find it. You know, it's probably on the Discovery Plus, you know, app. I'm sure it's probably on there. But if not, I know I've got the first season on DVD. I know that, so.
Oh, all right. Just showing off then. That's it. Fine.
A little bit.
Making me very jealous. Very jealous. Well, it's like, as I say, though, it's brilliant. And congratulations to going to places that most people don't, and covering some, like you say, a wonderful mixture of monsters and myths and legends to bring them to the public's attention. I suppose as well, you've developed a reputation as a regular speaker at events across North America now, Kenny. One of the things I'm always interested when I speak with people that appear at conferences is, when you get an invitation, how do you decide the subject you're going to do? Do you have an idea of what you want to do? Because I know you've got coming up shortly the Encounter Quest conference, which is down in Hamlet, North Carolina, coming up in April. I believe you're speaking about Dogman there.
Yes. Well, it really depends on the conference, what the focus is. If it's a Bigfoot conference, like for instance, I spoke at an event yesterday at a location called Do You Believe. They've got a 10-foot tall animatronic Bigfoot there. It's just it's amazing. And I spoke there with Steve Coles, who's another Bigfoot guy, Sasquatch detective guy. And so it was revolving around Bigfoot. So it really comes down to the event. As far as Encounter Quest, the one they asked me if I'd speak on Dogman. So it really comes down to whatever the event is focused on. And if I can you know, if it's a Bigfoot event, 9 times out of 10, they want me to speak on Bigfoot. For the most part, the organizers don't normally ask you what you're speaking on. There are locations that will ask you that. And every once in a while, somebody will ask you, hey, you know, we've got, you know, three people speaking on Bigfoot. This is a cryptid event. Can you speak on something else? Like, I was at Crypticon back in November of 2021. And which was great, because, you know, it covers all kinds of cryptids. So I covered the Jersey Devil and the Wendigo. Some people don't see the Wendigo or Wendigo, however one pronounces it. They don't see that, you know, as a cryptid. They see that really, you know, more as kind of like a spiritual type of entity, you know, that's taken over somebody. But, you know, at the same time, it could still fall under the cryptid realm. So I spoke on that. So it really depends. It really depends. I mean, if it's a Bigfoot focused event and that's what the people are there to hear about, then it's about Bigfoot.
So how's your itinerary looking for the rest of the year? You got many conferences booked in, planned in, taking you all over the North American continent, no doubt?
Yeah, I've got a few. I'd say this year, I haven't really jumped on a lot of them, because in my private life on a couple of things, there's been a few things I've had to work out. So usually by, I'd say maybe March or April, you know, I've got all the ones booked out that I'm going to be doing for the year. Right now I've actually had to turn some down just for certain different reasons. But as of right now, I've only got a few of them on the books right now, and they're still kind of up in the air. So, but obviously as you know, I start to book them, because I'm trying to make sure that I don't overcommit. Because I got a few things that I'm trying to work out personally right now that, you know, I don't want to commit to something and then it, you know, have to back out of it. That's the last thing you want to do. So,
yeah. Well, it as with anything in life, Kenny, you've got to get that balance, haven't you, my friend?
Yep. 100%. 100%. And that's the thing, is I also don't want to, you know, stretch myself until I get, you know, things kind of where I need them to be. And, you know, have people, you know, fly me out, you know, and pay me to stand there, not, you know, be, you know, not bring excellence to what I'm doing, you know, being so stretched and, you know, just doing it to do it. And, you know, I you know, a lot of these spots, speaking spots at events, those are important spots. And, you know, it's you don't want to take one up just to take one up. You know what I mean? It's like you want to make sure that you're ready, and, you know, you're able to do it. And again, not have to back out last minute, because you never want to do that to anybody. So once I get things in the next couple of months, you know, get things ironed out where I need them to be, then I'll be rocking and rolling. But you know, I recently changed careers, and so I'm just kind of balancing that out right now.
Yeah. Well, all power to you. I'm sure you'll find a way to get through it, my friend, and get back out there on the circuit. And like you say, often it's all about quality, not quantity, Kenny. So fair play to you, because some people wouldn't be that respectful, regardless to the audience or the organisers as well. So fair play to you for taking a step back and dealing with things in a proper and professional manner.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
You're very welcome. So, Kenny, where can everybody get a hold of a copy of your books, follow you online, and what else have you got planned coming up, my friend?
Well, I've got, as I mentioned offline, I've got another publication right now that I'm working on. So another signed contract for a publication would be on the fray. Hopefully releasing the beginning of August of this year. So I'm, you know, pretty excited about that. As far as getting in contact with me, you can find me on Facebook under Kenny W. Irish, the CryptoPunkologist. I'm on Instagram under Kenny Irish Author, Kenny Irish Author under Twitter. And as far as the publications, obviously the easiest way that you can get any of my books would just be to jump right on Amazon. Some of my publications are in, you know, select stores. But if, you know, you're on Walmart.com, you can order my books on there, Barnes & Noble, as well as Target. You can go to Target.com. You can order my books off of there. So, you know, there's plenty of opportunity to get them from different facets and different areas. But again, I mean, almost everybody that's, you know, right now listening to this is probably also on Amazon shopping. So you can always just jump right on over there.
Multitasking, that's the quality of the audience we have, Kenny.
Yes.
Well, listen, thank you as always for joining me. I'm eagerly looking forward to your next project because I know we've spoken about it and my lips are sealed. So I'm really looking forward to diving into that. So I know for a fact it won't be 2 years till we speak again, and hopefully we will have a great conversation about this upcoming project later in the year. I wish you all the very best. Good luck for everything, both professionally and personally. You take care of yourself, and we will speak soon, Kenny.
Great. Thanks, Paul. I appreciate you.